Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend show. This weekend show is going to be really a big picture outlook on markets, which have continued to show quite a bit of weakness, and trying to make sense of what's going on around the world with the U.S., the ongoing tariff news, and just what it means for markets. Because right now, people are worried about a larger market correction, maybe even a market crash. And clearly, we've seen money filter into a lot of the defensive assets. Please, everyone, go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast or YouTube channel. Just search The KE Report to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates. Without further ado, let's get into this weekend show, kicking off with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report on Substack. I'll include a link to Peter's Substack in the show notes on our website, YouTube, and podcast. Peter, let's start off with your take on what's going on globally here. The U.S. seems to be picking a tariff war with all kinds of different countries around the world. That is causing a lot of turmoil in terms of the markets. What's your take from this environment that we are in globally right now?
Well, the tariff situation, just as it did in 2018 and 2019, is causing not just sort of angst and nervousness, it's throwing mud in the gears of business. And people forget that in 2018, 2019, tariffs sent U.S. manufacturing into a recession. And that led to the Fed cutting interest rates in the middle of 2019. I was hoping, knowing that we were going to get tariffs because Trump likes them, for something more sort of strategic and focused with them to achieve whatever goal he wanted. But instead, we've gotten a scattershot approach, and it's creating a lot of problems. And I don't think that this is going to end up any different than it did in 2018. And potentially, this can be even broader. Countries are ready for retaliation. We've already seen it today after the steel and aluminum tariffs went on. And I don't think there's enough thought within the administration of the full sort of flow through of an impact that this has. That while you're trying to defend, in this particular case, U.S. industries, U.S. steel and aluminum, you're actually pricing U.S. manufacturers out of the global market, because we're going to be competing against firms outside the U.S. that are going to be able to source their raw materials at a much cheaper price and take market share from us. So I don't see anything good coming of this. I think that the market has spoken. That's just my opinion, but look at the market's opinion. The market has clearly spoken, and it doesn't like it.
Well, and Peter, just to complicate matters even more, yeah, I think that, you know, some of the farmers have not liked it. The manufacturers have not liked it. There's a lot of boomerang effects with these tariffs, because we get the retaliatory tariffs back from other countries, but it hurts domestic and international businesses. But you've been making the point that some of the market correction was already on tenuous ground because of what we'd already seen in the AI bursting with the DeepSeek news, and just some of the valuations being at such a frothy level that things were already looking for a reason to correct, and this tariff uncertainty has just added fuel to the fire. So maybe break down the structural things you were seeing before all this even heated up in the first place.
So with the context that we know, you know, the AI tech trade basically gave the market a second wind in late 2022, early 2023. I think beginning in July of last year, as the markets digested Q2 earnings from all the big names, particularly the hyperscalers and NVIDIA, is the market started to differentiate between those companies, those hyperscalers that are spending extraordinary amounts of money to build out these models, and then the beneficiaries of that spend being NVIDIA, Dell, and other infrastructure providers. But in the hyperscaler viewpoint was, okay, this is a lot of money you guys are spending, and you know, where are the revenues going to come from? And is it going to be eventually enough to substantiate all this spend? And then I think as the year progressed, those questions started to grow. And then, of course, I think DeepSeek was a game-changing event. I mean, my experience in the markets for many decades is when news comes out of nowhere and sort of shakes people, it's more than usually than just a one-time, one-day impact. And I think it woke people up to the fact that these AI models that all this money is being spent on is now a commoditized product. And you don't have to be a U.S. company to be able to develop this. You can be one that is located overseas. And so people are now, you know, questioning, okay, you're spending $20 billion a quarter, you being, you know, one of the hyperscalers, or $15 billion. And what are we getting for that if other people are doing it and giving it out for free? So I think that was a really game-changing thing. And mid-February, I wrote a note basically saying, I think the AI tech trade is over, you know, in terms of it dominating the markets and it's sort of carrying markets on its shoulders. And what we've seen is that to be the case. But that doesn't mean that, you know, everything else falls apart, because what we've seen is dramatic outperformance in European markets for, you know, specific reasons there, whether it's a huge amount of defense spending that we're going to see, the realization on the part of important politicians in the EU that they've smothered themselves from a regulatory and red tape perspective, and even just Germany recently easing their debt brake constraints. And then, of course, we've seen a nice rally in China, sort of triggered by the DeepSeek news, but people realizing that there are other stocks to buy other than the top seven. And then, of course, so that created an underlying fragility, in my opinion, when you have 35% of the S&P 500 being in these seven stocks, that's all of a sudden faltering. You better hand the baton off rather quickly to somebody else if you're going to maintain, you know, S&P levels. And, you know, you couldn't hand it off fast enough to other things. And then you throw in the tariffs and just worries about economic growth, because, you know, the three areas of economic strength, I've argued, has really been government spending and anything related to that. Well, DOGE and the intent of shrinking the budget deficit relative to GDP to something closer to 3 rather than 7. Well, that's a great thing, I believe, longer term, but in the short term, that's a major economic constraint potentially. You have AI spend has been a major driver of economic growth, whether it's, you know, hiring engineers or building out data centers. Well, now that's potentially in question of, or now we're getting to the point, are we overbuilding? And then upper income spending. And if the stock market continues to fall, well, then upper income spending is at risk. So no coincidence that today it's sort of flat. The 3-month and 10-year yield spread reinverted again. So I think there's legitimate concerns about the economy rolling over into recession if these three pillars of economic growth start to falter, because other parts of the economy are already in recession. Manufacturing is in a recession. Low to middle income spending is in a recession. The pace of existing home sales is in a recession. Global trade is essentially in a recession. So I think there are legitimate concerns out there. And I think it's easily explainable why we've had this pullback in markets. And then you throw in, you know, overvalued markets with this vulnerability that's growing, and it helps to explain what's going on here.
Let's dissect this market pullback a little bit more and get your opinion on just how deep it could go. Because look, the market's lost a lot of momentum in December, I feel like. Did reach a recent all-time high in February. I'm looking at the S&P. But then we've had this 10% decline in 4 weeks. Now, the 10% pullbacks are normal for markets. We had one back in July, but that one only lasted about a month. And then in 2023, we had a longer term pullback there. But again, this 10% decline has come in really under 4 weeks. It's been very quick. How much lower could this market go? Are we talking about a correction here that could last the rest of this year?
Corey, I don't know. I don't know whether the big seven stocks and what I said with the recession drag us down. Well, if we go into recession, market's going much lower. Trying to quantify it, you know, I've gave up that game a long time ago. All I know is that risks are growing. Valuations have given the market no room for error. And you got to be more careful. I do think, though, that there are opportunities out there. I mentioned international, and I do think that this international outperformance is not just a few month thing. that it's a multi-year thing. There are a lot of attractive markets or a lot of cheap stocks out there overseas, and there are cheap stocks in the US as well. But I think you have to understand of sort of the, you know, the investing playing field that we're on right now is much different than what people have gotten used to. And what is going to work in the coming years is going to be much different than what has worked in the prior few years.
Peter, I want to go back to something you said just a little while ago about the government spending aspect to how that figures into growth in the United States. And if the DOGE committee is cutting jobs and cutting government spending, you know, you're for that as a longer term thing to reduce the debt and the spend. But how does that affect the growth in the U.S.? Is money fleeing the U.S. to other countries and other markets because they're concerned we're going to have a recession? Are we in a stagflation? How are you looking at it?
So with the dollar, it's actually very interesting because, you know, obviously the world's so interconnected. And I'm going to go back to, you know, the Mag 7, for example. You know, the Mag 7 stocks literally became like a reserve asset for foreign holders, foreign central banks, just as U.S. Treasuries were a reserve asset, gold, a reserve asset. Big cap tech became a reserve asset. And just to, you know, to define that, the Norges Bank, the Norwegian central bank, as of December 31st, was the 10th largest holder of NVIDIA. They owned 324 million shares of NVIDIA. The Swiss National Bank, as of December 31st, owned 90 million shares of NVIDIA. The whole world has piled into these stocks. So it's no coincidence as money is leaving these stocks, foreigners selling these stocks, the dollar has correlated well with the Mag 7. As the Mag 7 has fallen, the dollar has fallen and vice versa. So there are major global fund flows that are driving things here as well and influencing the value of the dollar relative to those stocks.
With these policies that Trump is enacting, and quite frankly, the tariff war that is ongoing and seems to be ramping up with different countries, and now money moving into other markets outside of that U.S. dominance that we've seen for so long. Peter, do you think this is a bigger picture end to U.S. dominance here, where other countries find other trading partners and investors, kind of going on that last thread, just turn their back on U.S. markets?
I think maybe to an extent, you know, the U.S. is always going to be a very fertile place to invest for many different reasons. But, you know, on the margin, could money start? I mean, that's the thing is when you start to sort of take a baseball bat and start banging your trading partners over the head, they start to lose confidence in their desire to do business with us. And not just the business level. I mean, even on a travel perspective, you know, I hear stories about Canadians canceling their trips to the US and liquor stores taking Jim Beam off the shelves and California wines. And I mean, look what we've done to Europe. Europe is now going to spend a lot of money on defense, but they have very little interest in buying stuff from US defense contractors. They'd rather buy from their own. We've emboldened the Chinese to build out their entire, you know, tech sector. And which means that as they become more independent of us, the US chip sector, for example, is going to lose China as a customer. And not only lose China as a customer, could lose the entire Asian region as a customer. Because if you are in Japan or you are in Singapore and you have the choice to buy some tech product from China or the US and China can produce it cheaper than we can, well, who do you think they're going to buy it from? So this antagonistic approach towards our trading partners has the potential of backfiring. And that's something that I'm concerned about. And we'll see. I mean, I'm sounding maybe overly cautious. I mean, like I said, the US is still a phenomenal place to do business in and invest in, but we'll have to see, you know, when you bully somebody, you know, there's a response and we'll see to the extent of that response.
Well, Peter, you're not the only one that's in a defensive posture. It seems like most of the market is as well. There's a definite shift from some of the growth areas into value sectors like consumer staples or utilities getting a bid now. We've seen bonds get a little bit of a bid, but gold has definitely been picking up steam throughout the course of 2025. It's still over 2,900 at the time of this recording, and central banks around the world are buying a lot of gold. Is that part of the defensive playbook that other nations are using too and other citizens are using, is just buying into the precious metals as a store of value?
I think there's no doubt. We certainly encouraged we being the US and the EU, encouraged foreign central banks to own a lot of gold after Russia invaded Ukraine and half their central bank's reserves were confiscated, as we know. Then you fast forward to now, and you can imagine that foreigners are even more inclined to reduce their exposure to the US dollar and own more gold. So I think that's why you've seen a pretty persistent bid to gold, and even silver is catching up to gold. It still has a long way to go, but there's a bid to silver too. So I would definitely connect the dots to what is going on geopolitically, and certainly, you know, the economic weapon of tariffs leading to a rise in the price of gold.
From this point, what continues to drive the gold price? Is it just more of the same, more of this fear coming into the market, or is there another catalyst you think that is needed to push gold even higher?
Well, I'm never a fan of, you know, people have fear and let's buy gold. You know, gold's usually rallying for some other reason, whether it's a weaker dollar or falling real rates. To me, the next catalyst to take gold much higher is finally the Western buyer taking gold higher. You know, if you go back to, if you look at total ETF holdings of gold, it is still dramatically below its peak of 2020. There was over 110 million ounces of gold in these ETFs. Today, there's just 86 million. And it really fell precipitously beginning in, you know, March 2022, and the Fed started raising interest rates when Western investors said, hey, I can, and other central banks did as well, I can start getting yield for the first time in 15 years. I'm going to start buying bonds. Who needs gold? Doesn't pay me anything. Meanwhile, the other parts of the world saying, give me gold, give me gold. So I think now you have the possibility of a big catch-up trade where the Western world starts buying gold, and those ETF holdings get back to where they were at the peak in 2022 and the previous peak behind that, which was even higher in 2020.
Peter, you brought up the Fed there, and let's bring them into the equation as well. They have a big impact on interest rates. Of course, their two mandates are inflation and employment, but a lot of people came into this year and really came into the end of last year expecting more cuts. I don't know where you stand on the cut factor, but the market's all over the board and it's been up and down as far as the expectations. How do you think that plays into interest rates? How do you think that plays into the dollar?
I think that the Fed's in a really difficult spot here because of the tariffs. And I say that because first, going back to the 2018 example, and the Fed was going to dust off that sort of playbook that they were cutting rates in summer of 2019 in response to the manufacturing recession that tariffs caused. But, you know, they were able to do that because there was no consumer price inflation. There was producer price inflation. You know, companies had like an increase in their costs, but they ate it instead of passing it on. You know, this time around, companies may feel more licensed to pass it on. Also, what happens if the Fed starts cutting rates and Trump wakes up the next day and says, okay, I changed my mind, the tariffs are off? Then the market rips and the economy rebounds and the Fed just cut interest rates. So they're kind of frozen, I believe. Now, that said, if the unemployment rate rises, I mean, the last payroll number, the U6, the all-encompassing unemployment rate, rose to 8% from 7.5%. It was a 50 basis point rise in the unemployment rate in 1 month, to the highest level since October 2021. That had me concerned. If the Fed starts cutting interest rates in response to that, I don't think they're going to be able to get away with too many because of the uncertain, you know, because of the issue with the tariffs, and maybe they get taken off at any point in time. So it's a really tricky component here. And I just think that, you know, investors who are, you know, so used to the Fed bailing them out with a cut or a string of cuts, I just think they can't hang their hat on that.
Just such a fickle market now, especially with Trump in office. You just don't know what's coming. And I think it's not just the Fed that feels handcuffed. There's a lot of investors that just don't know what to do right now. We've outlined how gold, silver, those are doing well. International markets, those have seen money flow into them. Any other areas out there, Peter, where you're seeing an opportunity for investors that could say, look, I want to put my money somewhere and not have to worry about the day-to-day craziness that we get out of politics, somewhere that maybe could play some catch-up to what has been pretty good market environment for investors over the last few years?
I'm getting more and more positive on commodity stocks. I see just major supply deficiencies building, and I think tariffs are going to just muck up, you know, the global supply chains and increase the demand and desire to hoard commodities. And I'm just looking at I love the chart of the CRB Raw Industrials Index. That's as of yesterday's close. I'll get a fresh close in a bit today. Closed just shy of a multi-year high, and the chart just looks like it's carving out a classic bottom here. Copper today traded at the highest level since May of last year. I mentioned silver before. So I think there's some real opportunities in commodity stocks, particularly industrial metals, very bullish on ag. And to me, energy, particularly natural gas, but oil at below $70 is dirt cheap.
To that point, energy, yeah, nat gas has been on a tear lately. Oil has been kind of the opposite. It's been in a downward pressure. How do those factor into your outlook on inflation, because energy is such a big part of inflation?
So, yes. So the price of oil is down. Price of gasoline is down. But then we have the price of natural gas that is up notably. So there's some gives and takes, but I don't think that oil stays down at these levels. I know the Saudis and OPEC just announced a modest increase in production, but I think supply out there is actually tight if you look at the inventory numbers. Demand obviously is a question. If the U.S. economy goes into recession, well, China's reduced its demand. So no doubt there's a demand issue, but I think down here below 70, it's pretty cheap.
So since you like the commodity stocks, how do you play them? How do you play copper stocks? How do you play gold stocks? How do you even play energy stocks? What's your preferred method?
So we're long some of the big European ones because they're much cheaper than the U.S. ones, like BP and Shell. Long Canadian Natural Resources, as I think it's one of the best run oil and gas companies in the world. EQT and the pure natural gas play and some of the natural gas pipelines. Fertilizer stocks we're long. Along a bunch, you know, a bunch of the gold and silver miners, but also that have copper businesses as a play there. We don't own Freeport. We used to, but you can own that as well. And just I'm looking at other industrial metals to possibly own. And also not forgetting about uranium, which we're still long. That has pulled back here, but still bullish there as well.
Any concern that if we do have this contraction that some are worried about, that would crimp commodity demand? And could we be entering a stagflationary period where there's just very little growth? How would that affect commodities?
Well, yeah, there's definitely risk on the demand side for the reasons that I mentioned, but partially maybe offset by, you know, the hoarding that I talked about and, you know, issues with supply. So I think, you know, commodity investing generally, it's you got to pay a lot of attention on the supply side. And now with respect to gold miners, I don't necessarily have to think as much about the economy, right? You know, in fact, if the economy falters and the Fed's cutting rates, that's going to help gold even more. So you got to think about that as well. And with respect to ag, you know, the global demand for food is going to continue to go up. And so I think fertilizer stocks also less worried about the cyclicality of the economy and just focused more on the supply side of, you know, potash and phosphate and nitrogen, for example.
Yeah, that's such a good point about precious metals, even ag too. But when it comes to more of those industrial metals, what about China? How much does that filter into your analysis? And what is your outlook for China? It's seen a bit of a rebound, but still nowhere to the extent that China bulls thought even a couple of years ago.
Well, China's still struggling with the downturn in their housing market, which is still probably years to go. But the pace of deterioration, I think, is really slowing. The pace of housing price declines is slowing. So that is, to me, a very big deal. And it seems that China sort of got some of its mojo back with DeepSeek and also Xi meeting up with a bunch of tech executives. Like he's sort of blessing them again. He, you know, they made a colossal mistake by banging their innovative tech entrepreneurs over the head. And now that I think they realize the error of their ways and they're trying to bring them back into the sort of the politically friendly fold, I think that's a really big deal. And China's dominating in EV manufacturing and solar panels and the electrical and robotics. And I mean, they're doing a lot of exciting stuff. And, you know, we've emboldened that because we've incentivized them to figure it out on their own, and they are. So I'm actually think people have left the Chinese economy for dead. And I think that's a big mistake.
What about critical minerals? They were the flavor of the day a couple of years back. Everything was focused on the energy transition, on EVs, on renewable power, and the huge demand there would be for things like lithium, cobalt, but nickel, copper. Now, with the Trump administration coming in, less of an interest in that narrative, but still a lot of policy initiatives that were already put into place. How are you looking at things like critical minerals?
You know, I mean, critical meaning like rare earths, for example.
Well, just any of the things for the energy transition, lithium, nickel, copper.
Okay, so those, yes, yeah. Right, yeah, you know, the energy transition has definitely been stunted. I think physics, the reality of physics has all of a sudden mattered, and that people have realized that wind and solar is not necessarily the most efficient way of garnering and storing energy compared to nuclear, for example. But, you know, there's still going to be renewable buildouts. And, you know, lithium, you know, there's still a lot of lithium out there. So I know prices have collapsed and, you know, maybe there's a trade there. So I don't have as much of an opinion on lithium, but, you know, more so copper and nickel and some of the others that, again, if, you know, these tariffs, while specifically it's on steel and aluminum, you know, there's a desire around the world to get people's hands on these critical minerals. And as I keep using the word hoarding, to hoard them because people understand the importance of it.
All right, Peter, we'll wrap it up here. It sounds like there could be a pretty significant shift here into commodities. Foreign investors, commodities, hard assets really have been left behind over the last couple decades as more money flew into financial assets. But maybe it really is changing this time, led by politics and also just led by what happens. Markets are cyclical, and maybe it is time for commodities and even the commodity stocks to pick up some of that money that flew into all these other tech stocks and all the other sectors. Again, Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report on Substack. Highly recommend you follow Peter on his Substack to stay up to date on a daily basis. Key news, data, and market moves that he highlights to his subscribers. Peter, great having you on the show. Thanks for taking time with us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate having me on.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.